The British government announced yesterday that it will break up the Royal Bank of Scotland, Lloyds Banking Group, and Northern Rock. These institutions were all considered too big to fail and were bailed out by British taxpayers at the height of the financial crisis. Although the American government is considering similar legislation, Neil Ferguson argues that the political will to break up our own too-big-to-fail institutions is dwindling. He joins me now to discuss his book, The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World, and the legislative actions that are needed to avert another crisis. The book is published by Penguin. I'm very pleased that it brings to our show Mr. Ferguson, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard, a senior research fellow at Oxford University, and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Welcome back to our show.
Pleasure to be here.
Do you think that the British government is taking the right approach?
I think I do. I think it's taking it partly under pressure from the European Commission. Nelly Kroes, who's the commissioner responsible, has been leaning not only on the British government, but on other governments too. And I think that's justified, because when you look at the scale of the disaster that was Royal Bank of Scotland, it would be completely unjustifiable to leave that institution intact with vast amounts of taxpayers' money already having been sunk into it.
Well, 70% of the Royal Bank of Scotland and 43% of Lloyd's is owned by British taxpayers.
70% and rising, because in fact they needed yet more money stuffed into them.
So they were effectively nationalised,
yes,
weren't
they?
Yes,
they were. They were in all but name. And I think, rightly, the feeling in Europe is that these institutions have proved themselves not only to be too big, but to be too big to exist.
Did the British government place more restrictions on the cash handed to these institutions than the U.S. government did when it was bailing out its financial institutions?
Not hugely. I think it's important to realize there's been quite a fight going on in London about this. The government of Gordon Brown has not been particularly aggressive. I think it's been cajoled into this action. In many ways, if you listen to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who is our equivalent of the Treasury Secretary, Alistair Darling, talk, you'd think that really nothing other than a little local difficulty happened in the last couple of years. The pressure has come partly from the European Commission, as I said, and also partly from the Bank of England. One of the most powerful calls for radical financial reform came in a speech that the governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, made in Edinburgh just a week or so ago, an extremely powerful speech, which I'm glad to say acknowledged a debt to financial history. He made the point that this crisis had its precedents in Scottish history. Scottish financial history has been a long tale of instability, and that it simply couldn't be right that an institution like the Royal Bank of Scotland could end up with a balance sheet larger than the gross domestic product of the United Kingdom.
Well, the British government has forced Lloyd's and the Royal Bank of Scotland to not pay out cash bonuses to staff earning over £39,000. I guess that's around $65,000 in this year. You wrote in an article for Newsweek that the focus on bonuses is a red herring.
I think it is a red herring, because this is really a symptom of a more profound problem, and it's not one of the causes of the crisis. And I think it's a mistake for government to start micromanaging pay packages. Something much more profound is wrong with the system than merely the size of bonuses that were paid to executives. And I think the problem with this, Leonard, is that it's a distraction. The public can understand the idea of people being paid too much, and million-dollar bonuses or million-pound bonuses are egregious to most voters' ears.
But doesn't it also reveal a disconnect in many sectors of the financial community? Well, I mean, you know, at the same time that people are suffering all around America, and to some degree they can be blamed for much of this suffering, they're still handing out million-dollar bonuses.
This is true, and of course it's one of the reasons that I begin The Ascent of Money by drawing a contrast between the pre-crisis pay package of Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, and the median American Joe the Plumber. The gap is absolutely vast. But we need to ask ourselves why. Why was it possible for the financial services sector to grow so bloated in relation to the rest of the economy? And why was it possible for a relatively small number of institutions, maybe a dozen, to end up controlling 60% or thereabouts of the assets of the entire financial system of the United States? Because I don't think you can really explain the big bonuses before you explain the profitability of these institutions. And that's really the key point. We need to understand why they were able to pay that kind of money. And the answer, which is one of the key points the book makes, was that excessive leverage and excessive risk-taking by these institutions was the only way they could juice their returns and make themselves so profitable. So they were making this kind of money by taking very large and risky positions with borrowed money. That's the key to the crisis. If you address that problem and say that it's simply not possible for an institution to be leveraged 30 to 1 or 40 to 1 or 50 to 1, as institutions like the Royal Bank of Scotland or Citigroup were, then the whole compensation issue will be addressed.
Well, since this is a financial history of the world, do we have historical precedents for this sort of thing?
There's certainly historical precedents for spectacular bank blow-ups. I was telling my Harvard class just the other day about the events of late 1930 when an institution called the Bank of United States, they didn't have the definite article there, Bank of United States, which was very popular with immigrants in New York, blew up. And it blew up despite a faint attempt to find a buyer for it. It was, in fact, the Lehman Brothers of the Great Depression. And after that point, the hemorrhaging of bank capital and the disintegration of the banking system really spiraled out of control. So I think we know from past experience that excessively leveraged institutions with balance sheets vastly larger than their capital base are something that can go wrong. And we really don't want them to come into existence again. This is a fundamental problem. We're wasting our time if we try to control the pay packets. We need to address the fundamental question of whether there can be institutions that are too big to fail right at the core of our financial system. And right now, nothing is being done in the United States to change that, whereas I think moves are being made in Europe.
Well, I remember some years back where we were talking about the potential for a crisis, and I was reassured by any number of economists that we had learned a lot from the Great Depression and that we had all sorts of things that had been put into place so that we wouldn't have something like that happen again. And here we are, and we're learning that an awful lot of looking the other way. Bernie Madoff just talked about how stupid the people who came to investigate him were.
Well, if you talked to me in 2006, I can't remember if we did, you would have heard a different story, because I was warning then that a major liquidity crisis would blow up highly leveraged institutions. I couldn't get many people in the financial sector to listen to that argument. And indeed, in the book, I tell the story of giving a very pessimistic presentation to a fancy investment bank conference in Lyford Key in the Bahamas and practically having bread rolls thrown at me.
My guest is Neil Ferguson, who's The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World, has just been released in a paperback edition. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It was first released just a year ago in hardcover.
That's right.
And a lot's happened over the past year. You have added an afterword. Which you call the Descent of Money.
And but I rewrote the introduction. I give it some updates.
Well, have you been forced to rethink any of the ideas you had as a result of the crisis?
I don't think so, because the point of the book was to write something that explained a major financial crisis, and I conceived of it before the crisis began. In a way, the crisis happened as I was putting the finishing touches to the book, which gave me a combination of a feeling of vindication and a feeling of terror, because I really wondered what would happen next that would take us out of the realm of the book's argument. But no, we remain pretty firmly within the realm of The Ascent of Money, which is a history of financial crises and tries to show that it's pretty difficult to come up with a system that is crisis-proof. Financial crises have been around as long as the financial system. The first stock market bubble was in Paris in 1719. So we've got to be careful of making, I think, the erroneous assumption that we could design a perfect regulatory framework which would solve this problem and rule out financial crises. I think they'll just keep on coming with almost any regulatory regime you devise.
You're tracing the centrality of finance to all elements of human history here, and you're doing it in a Whiggish tradition.
Gosh, I've never been called a Whig before.
Well, it holds that history follows a path of inevitable progression.
Yeah, that's
and
not
improvement.
What the book says. I think the book is not making a Whiggish argument. The Ascent of Finance is a...
You've never been called a Whig before?
No, on the contrary, more likely to be called a Tory. And yeah. I guess I even spent 2 years teaching at Peterhouse, Cambridge, the heartland of anti-Whig historiography. No, The Ascent of Money as a title is a kind of ironical title. Money has ascended into a position of dominance over our lives. The financial system has evolved, but it has not necessarily evolved to become more perfect. I actually quite clearly argue in the end of the book that it's an evolutionary system, but evolution doesn't necessarily produce ever better organisms. In fact, it can produce a whole bunch of completely strange organisms that can go extinct if the climate changes. So it's not a Whiggish account, nor, of course, is it an apocalyptic post-Marxist account predicting the collapse of all financial capitalism.
Yeah, there are critics who are saying that capitalism needs to be rethought.
Well, it needs to be reformed, but it's continually having to overhaul the way capitalism operates. It reminds me of Churchill's line about democracy. It's the worst of all possible economic systems, apart from all the others that have been tried from time to time. So I think it's a great headline, the end of capitalism or the end of finance. But the reality is that it's actually the end of the Basel II regime of bank capital adequacy, which is a much less good headline, much less sexy, but it happens to be a very important part of what went wrong.
In the afterword, you write that Thorsten Veblen first posed in 1898 the question, why is economics not an evolutionary science? So is there an answer that everyone can agree with?
My answer would be a kind of math envy. Economists, since the time of Keynes, have become more and more concerned to prove themselves to be good applied mathematicians. And the more economics abstracted itself away from the real world by making a series of assumptions that made the math more elegant, the less useful it became as a discipline. We're seeing a huge crisis of economics as a discipline right now. It's breaking up before our very eyes, particularly the theory of efficient markets that implied all sorts of craziness about the way that markets work. For example, that information would flow perfectly and prices would always reflect all the available information immediately and that they would always be liquid and so on and so on.
Which Keynes argued against.
Which Keynes was very skeptical about. And we've seen a revival of Keynes. I mean, there's a kind of neo-Keynesian move afoot. It's right at the heart of the Obama administration's strategy. But I think more interesting than the Keynesian revival, which in some ways is quite boring, is the development of evolutionary economics in the strict sense that Andrew Lowe at MIT means it. In other words, we need to think of the economic process as rather like processes in the natural world, where species evolve and periodically go extinct. I think the investment banks went extinct last year. That's something that even in my most pessimistic moments in 2006, I would not have predicted. The other interesting thing that's happening, Leonard, is the way in which psychology, behavioral psychology, is coming in to the realm of economics and displacing the old model of man as rational, calculating machine. I think that model has pretty much gone out the window.
Since we were talking a bit about Keynes, were you in favor of the stimulus plans that were first pushed by the Bush administration and have been continued by the Obama administration?
I am an agnostic on fiscal stimulus. I'm a believer in monetary stimulus. I think that the two prongs of our strategy to avoid a Great Depression were monetary and fiscal, and of the two, I think the monetary one has been the more effective. That is to say, I think Ben Bernanke did exactly what he had to do in expanding the Fed balance sheet and avoiding a mass rash of bank failures, which Milton Friedman argued was the principal cause of the Great Depression. What we've done on the fiscal side has always been more troubling to me. We already had a deficit, a structural deficit, nothing to do with Keynes, and the crisis made it bigger because of the way in which revenues fell and expenditures rose, and then we added a stimulus on top of that, $787 billion, which Congress decided how to spend. I'm really doubtful that this has had a major impact on economic growth in the U.S. I think the monetary easing has had a much more important role to play. And what's more, I think there are negatives, there are downsides to this huge expansion of government borrowing that are going to manifest themselves in the year ahead when it becomes clear that the U.S. has embarked on an unsustainable fiscal trajectory with $9 trillion
$1 trillion of new debt forecast to be issued in the next 10 years. So I think there's a question mark over what I'm calling this Keynesian revival. I'm not even sure that if Keynes were here, he would necessarily agree with, for example, Paul Krugman, that deficits can't be too big and that we should make them even bigger and we need a new stimulus. I think if Keynes were here, he'd be rather cautious about that idea.
Part of that is in response to the fact that most economists expect unemployment to hit 10% before year end, and in many states it's already there. And it's always pointed out that a recovery can't really take hold if job creation doesn't pick up at a much faster pace.
I think that's right. I think it's much too early to proclaim sustained recovery. We saw positive numbers in the last quarterly report of gross domestic product, but an awful lot of that reflected government policy that won't last. The Cash for Clunkers program, the incentive to first-time home buyers, and government spending itself went up. I mean, that's one of the key components of GDP. That doesn't point to a sustained recovery in my eyes. And I think if you look ahead next year, I'll be extremely surprised if the administration gets the 3.5% growth for the whole year that it forecast right at the beginning of the year in its budget. Now, we have a long way still to go because, apart from anything else, the US economy is tottering under a mountain of debt, equivalent to around 350% of gross domestic product, if you include public and private debt. It's very hard for consumers to go shopping in the way that they used to do under that kind of a debt burden.
A listener says that he heard Alan Greenspan say that he had expected the downturn to right itself. That never happened in the 29 crash. Has it ever righted itself?
Well, most post-war recessions did right themselves, even the nasty ones in the early 70s and early 80s. And a lot of commentators who draw their data from the last 50 or so years predicted a similar process this time around. But this isn't an ordinary recession. I'd call this a near depression. We had about a quarter, maybe nearly a third of a Great Depression, and then we pulled out of it. And we pulled out of it because of that huge monetary easing that the Fed undertook, and maybe partly because of the fiscal stimulus. And I think the big question now is whether the recovery that we've begun to see signs of can be sustained into next year. A lot of people talk in this rather contrived way about V-shapes and L-shapes. I've even heard somebody say the recovery will be like the square root symbol. That is to say, we sort of go up and then we go up, we go down, then we go up and then we go straight along, we flatline. I think that's not an implausible scenario. I'm pretty sure that growth over the next, say, 5 years will be significantly lower on average than it was in the previous 5 years to this crisis.
Germany is taking a different approach. Do you think it makes more sense?
I think,
or is it just based on the fact that Germany has a different kind of economy?
I think the German reluctance to go on a big fiscal splurge was reasonable, and it hasn't been a particular negative for them. Their problem is that the euro is becoming ever stronger as a currency relative, not only to the dollar, but to the Chinese currency, which is pegged to the dollar. The next phase of this crisis will be a period in which the dollar weakens. And as it weakens, the pressure will be displaced to Japan and to Europe. And I think the big worry for Germans, who, after all, are among the world's biggest exporters, is that as the euro appreciates relative to the dollar, they're the ones who are going to bear much of the pain of this so-called global rebalancing.
I'm talking with Neil Ferguson, whose book, The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World, was a New York Times bestseller when it was released in hardcover last year. And now it has been revised a bit and issued in paperback by Penguin. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Neil Ferguson. His book, The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World, has just been reissued in a new paperback edition. And this book was accompanied by a PBS documentary modeled on Jacob Bronowski's series, The Ascent of Man. Did you write the script for that documentary?
Yes, I did. I did, and I felt it was a very good way to reach an even broader audience than the book could reach, because part of the cause of this crisis has been ignorance of financial history, not only on the part of ordinary people taking out mortgages that they couldn't afford to fund, but on the part of chief executives of major Wall Street institutions. Financial history is a poor relation in the academy. There aren't that many financial history courses out there if you just look at the major universities. And I hope the Ascent of Money's done something to change that.
Well, I want to get into that history, but what you just said made me think that I have a strong suspicion most people don't have a clue as to what a hedge fund really does. And maybe we can get into that a little later. You write about the financial markets as the mirror of mankind. What should we see in that mirror?
It's not entirely pretty. I think one of the things that's most striking about financial markets is that they reflect human psychology and our tendency to veer from gloom to euphoria and back again. And they amplify it in the sense that we act together. We behave as a crowd, as a herd. One minute, we love dot-com companies, and we value them at vast multiples of their earnings. The next minute, we decide the whole thing is a scam, and they fall through the floor. And it's that makes financial history fascinating, because it reflects a fundamental truth about the human predicament. We're constantly changing our view of the future. We're constantly going from being very optimistic about it, which we were in 2006, to being deeply despondent about it, which we were a year ago just now.
So it reflects what we value and our weaknesses.
It is all about valuation, because after all, what does a stock market do? It essentially makes a prediction about what companies will be earning in the years ahead. And the truth is, we don't know. I mean, we don't know because so much is uncertain, but we desperately want to know. So we go around, often in rather superstitious ways, developing models that tell us what the future will bring. Most of these are spurious. I mean, there are people called technical analysts and chartists who spend their lives, they get paid to do this, drawing elaborate lines on stock market charts and predicting what the stock market will do next, whereas in reality, they haven't the faintest idea.
So why would any rational person other than Warren Buffett rely on the market to help save for college, retirement, or anything else? And I asked that question, I must admit, when the president was talking about, President Bush was talking about privatizing Social Security and tying retirement to the stock market. We can only guess what would have happened if that had occurred, and then we'd gone through this terrible economic dip.
Sure, but you bizarrely have more faith in the federal government as a custodian of your Social Security contributions, when in fact we know that the Social Security Trust Fund will be bust in just a few years.
Well, that's partly because the government's been borrowing from it like mad. If it had just done what it had promised, I think that we'd be fine.
Right, and there's a strong argument for large-scale, unitary state pension funds, as long as you can trust politicians not to raid them, but you never can. Even in a democracy. No, I think the answer to the question, Leonard, is that we don't really have a better strategy than to have a diverse range of different forms of investment for our future. And it's that diversification that's often been lacking. You know, most Americans, like most Europeans, have as their biggest asset their home. And one of the great mistakes we made in the last 20 years was to incentivize home ownership to the point of really a reductio ad absurdum. We took the whole policy to an absurd extreme. And the result was that a great many people staked their futures on a one-way, highly leveraged, completely unhedged bet on a single asset class, real estate. And the costs have been absolutely huge for the people who bought at the top of the market and borrowed as much as they could.
Recently, there's been a questioning as to whether 401ks are the best method to save for retirement. With such potential volatility in the market and most people ill-equipped to understand when to sell and how to manage their investments, do you agree that this may not be the wisest approach for most people?
The most foolish approach is to have all of your life savings tied up just in the stock market and a house. I mean, if that's all you've got, you are just not ready to withstand the slings and arrows of outrageous financial fortune. Diversification's about the only thing that you can rely on in an uncertain world. And I think one of the challenges we face, and it's a challenge we're a long way from meeting, is creating vehicles so that ordinary citizens can protect their wealth, their savings, better than they currently can. The story that all you needed to do was tie it up in bricks and mortar and then play the S&P 500 was a fairy story, and it's cost a great many people a huge quantity of their life savings in the last 2 years. That's something that we need to think much more about.
You seem to be less trusting in government, and a listener says, what about the responsibility of the government in the form of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae in the mortgage crisis?
Oh, amen. I mean, I think one of the great fables about the crisis is that this was all the result of deregulation and rampant market forces and the fat cats of Wall Street. Well, they certainly played their part. But one of the striking things about the crisis was that it actually was caused by some of the most regulated institutions, and your listener rightly mentions Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the pillars on which the U.S. Mortgage market in many ways rests, which were directly under the oversight of Congress and which were run even more disastrously than the worst-run bank. So we have a problem. It was well-regulated, or at least supposedly well-regulated institutions that helped blow the place up, big commercial banks and these mortgage underwriters, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It wasn't the unregulated hedge funds, which many people thought would cause the next crisis. In fact, they're pretty much innocent as charged. So when we sit down and say,
except
what we
for
need-
the people who are being sent to jail.
Except for the so far very small number of fraudsters who are currently facing criminal charges. I must say, I find it surprising how few people so far have in fact been hauled up for fraud. I think many more deserve to be, and perhaps we'll see more in the months ahead.
Well, in 2000, there were 3,873 hedge funds with $490 billion in assets. Now, 8 years later, first quarter of 2008, in fact, there were 7,601 funds with $1.9 trillion in assets. That was a major growth. Most people have no idea what a hedge fund even does.
This is part of my evolutionary theory. A new species, more or less, new came into existence and then proliferated in extraordinary numbers in benign conditions. I mean, what is a hedge fund? A hedge fund originally was a fund that could make money by short selling, by betting against stocks, betting that companies would do badly and that their stocks would underperform. But in recent times, a hedge fund has basically become a vehicle whereby fund managers take money from people and charge them a 2% management fee. That's 2% of the amount of money that they invest in the hedge fund every year, plus 20% or thereabouts of any profits that they make. And they can do absolutely anything they like within or possibly outside the law. That's all a hedge fund is now. It's just basically it's a system of compensating people who invest money, mostly for the wealthy at first. But now, of course, hedge funds have played a very big part in managing money for institutions, pension funds, university endowments, with somewhat disastrous results in the case of my own university. So hedge funds are very much a part of the system now.
So it's simply a matter of us saying, I'm no expert, you, Neil Ferguson, are, I'll give you my money,
sure.
You promise me that I'll make money as a result.
What I promise you will be something like, I promise you double-digit returns. So I'm going to give you returns above 10%, and they won't be too volatile. They'll be consistently in the 10 to 15% range. And you go, wow, I'll take that every time. And if you can do 20%, better and better. And off I go with your money. And I'm guaranteed 2% of your money, even if I do nothing at all, and 20%, a fifth of any profits that I make. Even if it's only 5%. Pretty attractive proposition from my point of view. What do? Well, I can simply go out and borrow against the money that you've given me and put on some very basic trades with the leverage generating the returns. And remember, a huge number of the strategies that made finance look so profitable in the 10 years or so before the crisis were based on borrowing, multiplying
the investment.
Being a bookie. Well, actually, you know, being a bookie in some ways is less risky, and betting on horses is probably more rational than giving your money to many of the hedge funds that are out there.
My guess is Neil Ferguson, his book, The Ascent of Money, or Ascent of Money, is what is it? Our listeners are complaining that I'm sounding very British here.
I say The Ascent.
Yeah, and I say The Ascent. Okay. It is published in paperback now by Penguin. You write that money amplifies our tendency to overreact, to swing from exuberance when things are going well, to deep depression when they go wrong. Booms and busts are product of our personal emotional volatility. In your opinion, what should we have learned about ourselves from this crisis then?
Well, I think we need to realize that because we behave this way, the system needs to be counter-cyclical and not pro-cyclical. In other words, we need to set up institutions that don't magnify and make bigger our already inherent predisposition to swing from gloom to euphoria and back. And that, for example, applies in the realm of banks. Banks at the moment have a tendency to act pro-cyclically, horrible word, in the sense that they will lend tremendously generously when things are going well, and then they will tighten when things go badly, which magnifies the problem. They'll get very, very leveraged when things are going well, and then they'll try and draw in their horns when things go badly. One idea that's being discussed by regulators on both sides of the Atlantic, which I think makes a lot of sense, is to make banks build up a cushion in terms of their capital when things are going well, so that when they go badly, there isn't that contraction effect. So that's the kind of lesson we have to learn.
Can we institute policies that prevent institutions from becoming too big to fail?
Yeah, absolutely we can. We used to have them. I mean, it used to be impossible, for example, for a commercial bank to engage in investment banking activities. This was the Glass-Steagall Act introduced in the Great Depression, repealed in 1999.
We also prevented them from being in more than one state.
Right. In fact, the U.S. banking system until very recently was one of the most fragmented in the Western world. It was one of the distinguishing features of the U.S., that there were lots and lots and lots of small banks. So it's perfectly within our power to return to an age of more fragmented financial services. We do not need these behemoths, these leviathans, or dinosaurs, if you like, on life support.
You're calling this a really you're saying we should apply antitrust laws to financial services.
It's not
quite
allowing
that. them to become so conglomerate.
I thought about this a lot. It's not quite that, because when you look at the degree of concentration in banking, it doesn't come close to violating the norms in antitrust. The concentration isn't that great, precisely because there are lots and lots of these smaller banks out there that are, quote, too small to save. So we can't really justify this on antitrust ground. I think we have to justify it on the basis of systemic stability. And we cannot have a situation in which all the profits are, in a sense, privatized and all the losses are socialized when a major financial institution gets into trouble. It's tremendously asymmetrical that all the costs get borne by the taxpayers, but the people who ran Lehman Brothers, the people who ran Bear Stearns, the people who ran Merrill Lynch, the people who ran Countrywide in the good times, well, they get to keep all the money that they made after tax in those good times. That can't be right.
A caller asks, do Americans pay less in taxes on capital gains than others, like the Irish?
I think I'm right in saying that they do, but I have that kind of uncomfortable feeling I get when I'm asked a question that is slightly beyond my expertise. I'm not a tax accountant. Maybe, I'm not sure. I think one of the things that's clear is that the American system of taxation is not as superior as many people assume to some European systems. Living in New York City, in terms of what you pay in taxation, is exactly the same as living in most West European states.
Well, during the campaign, it was pointed out that the American corporations pay more in taxes, but then the counterargument was, but they have so many loopholes that they wind up paying less than corporations anywhere else in the world. We have the more complicated, the more Byzantine tax laws.
That's right. And the excessive complexity of the U.S. tax code is a major problem. If you wanted to solve this country's many problems, it wouldn't be difficult in the sense that you could rationalize the tax system, have something much, much simpler for individuals. You could possibly even get rid of corporation tax, just tax individuals. But you would need some other compensating source of federal revenue, which is why I would argue for the introduction of a value-added tax and the European model, a tax on transactions, essentially, which is clearly the missing link in the American scheme at the moment. At the moment, the U.S. has a structural deficit in its public finances, which will go on regardless of how the economy does, and that's not sustainable. What we need is a much simpler tax code, because the costs of all this complexity are very serious, and the benefits largely flow to accountants and lawyers. And we need some new source of taxation other than income tax in order to bring the federal government back into the black.
Neil Ferguson's The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World, is published now in paperback by Penguin Books. And Neil, as always, it's been a great pleasure having you on our show.
Thank you very much.
This is WNYC, New York Public Radio. On tomorrow's show, Ken Ouellette examines the rise of Google and how it's turned the world of traditional media on its head. Then, a look at the life and writings of Ayn Rand. Also, LA Times film critic Kenneth Turan on the theatrical legacy of Joe Papp. Plus, our latest underreported segment looks at how foreign governments use lobbying firms in Washington, D.C. to get what they want. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Barbara Kahn, Miranda Schaefer, and Angela Sheldon. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.